Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello, and welcome to episode 66 of Dogcast Radio. In today's show, we have a short story from the Diplomatic Dog of Barbados author, Winfried Pepink.
The diplomatic dog, DD for short, walked slowly to the gate and through his narrowed eyes looked in the direction of the camel pack and watched them shuffling down the road.
Plus, we have the Dogcast Radio news and a response from a listener about the issue of breed-specific legislation. But before all that, we talk to J.F. Englert, author of the excellent and entertaining book Dog About Town. I thoroughly enjoyed reading this book, and of course the main character appealed to me, as he's a Labrador. This was what I wanted to talk to Jonathan about first.
For anyone that hasn't read the books, I think, you know, the first thing we need to talk about is the voice of the narrator. It was Randolph's voice in the books, because he is the narrator, but he's no ordinary narrator. So how did that develop?
Well, I have to say that Randolph really sprung to life almost in completely and seemed to have a life of his own from the beginning. It's funny that you start with that question of his voice and it being unique, because really that's the origin of the entire book and the entire series.
Yeah.
So it's a really important question.
Well, yes, because I've never come across anything like that before. I mean, people have used, you know, the dog as the voice, but he's just like no dog, you know, you've ever known. He just, he shames you into thinking, I'm going to go to the library and read some of these
culture
stuff.
He does. He shamed me, too, a few times. it's very strange. I was working, I was actually working a night shift. I was working on another book, and actually needed to earn some extra money after the advance ran out. And I was working this night shift, and all of a sudden, it was near Christmas, and I really just had that first line. The first line of Dog About Town just popped into my head. And from there, I wrote about five pages in a kind of white heat, of maybe very quickly. And I looked at it, and I thought, this is something. And knew that there was this narrator, you know, this new narrator on the scene, this new... I mean, it was very odd. I mean, I had a Labrador Retriever myself, so I had a new insight into dog life in Manhattan.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, it was a strange thing, and I guess that was one of those experiences where you just recognize. I put the five pages down for about a year,
because
I didn't really know what to do with it, and then about basically the following winter, I wrote the book. And just followed the lead of those first five pages because they was very definite narration. So Randolph really sprung to life entirely at that one moment.
Yeah, because he uses
and he does have a good vocabulary. I mean, he speaks better than I usually do.
He does, but he is very likable.
Yeah, he is likable. And at first, it's funny because I read one review, and I think if there's one, you know, problem with the first book, it's that I'm sure there are numerous, it's certainly not perfect, but I mean, the one stumbling block for some people might be the opening where they mistake him for a snob. I read one review where the person almost gave up on Randolph because they felt, oh gosh, you know, this dog's a snob, he's too beyond. But then they kept reading and they realized that in fact Randolph is pretty vulnerable. He's a pretty vulnerable character. I mean, and I think that makes him likable.
Yes.
So he's not just kind of showing his erudition out there, you know, and sort of flaunting it, or trying to shame his readers at all. I mean, he wouldn't mind, I'm sure, having his readers read more.
Well,
you know,
yes.
And read more Dante, maybe. It was kind of interesting. I think the beginning might misrepresent him in a way, although he doesn't intend it. I mean, I don't intend him to be misrepresented from the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, well, I mean, for anybody that starts it, do keep reading, because he's a very enjoyable character to get to know, definitely.
Yeah, and I think he is, actually. I'm happy to say that he came through pretty well without my mangling of him. And then the second book, Dog Among Diplomats, he's similarly voiced. It's always, yeah. So in other words, it's always first person. For any reader who's maybe not aware of that, it's first person narrated by dog. Now, Virginia Woolf wrote a book that I learned later called Flush.
Yeah.
And I haven't read it yet, but it was apparently one of her best-selling, most, you know, best-selling books in her lifetime. Yeah. And it's about Elizabeth Barrett Browning's dog, Flush, who was a, King Charles, I think, Cavalier Spaniel. Mangling that. But who was kidnapped several times, and because that was a common occurrence apparently in England in the 19th century, dog kidnapping.
Good grief. Wow.
Yeah, and anyway, so she wrote a book, and I haven't read it, and in fact hadn't heard about it until after I wrote A Dog About Town, and I bumped into a Virginia Woolf scholar who said, oh, you know, she wrote a book narrated by a dog. So I thought that was interesting.
Sorry, it's also interesting to know that dog crime isn't that new in the UK either.
No, no, it has a history, right? I mean, and apparently, I guess at some point in Victorian England, it was, I imagine maybe dogs were treated. Well, you see, you have all those, the portraits of dogs.
Yes.
You know, in the family portraits where the dogs are kind of featured. So clearly there was a period when dogs were, you know, kind of loved in the, or part of the family in a similar way that they are now.
Oh, yes, yeah. But, and obviously open to ransom as well.
And bad times, too.
Yes, yeah. Okay, we've talked a little bit about Dog About Town. Can you give us a taste of it so that people will think, oh, yes, I'll go and read that?
Okay, well, this is a good place to read. One of the things that I sort of a high compliment was a few people have noted that there's a P.G. Woodhouse flavor to some of to some of Randolph's observations, and so I've been pleased by that, because there is, you know, the way they classify books these days, you know, they put this in the mystery category, and it is a mystery, but the fact is the mystery is in a way secondary.
Yes,
it's probably closer to number one, the Ladies Detective Agency, than it is to, you know, a straight, really hardcore mystery. It's just not. You know, the mystery is weak, but the observations are strong, and I think the satire is strong.
Oh,
and the story, you know, and the characters. And so it's meant to be it's sort of lighter. They call these cozies these days, but I don't think that's accurate. but it is what it is, you know, as they say in New York. It is what it is, and I think it's a, it's really a general reading book. But in this scene, Randolph is talking about life in New York, and life in New York is strange for dogs because they really can't run off the leash anywhere. They don't have, with exception of Central Park, where they can sometimes. They're restricted to the sidewalks or to dog runs, and dog runs are these penned enclosures. I'm not sure where you live in England, but I'm sure in London they probably have things like this.
Possibly.
But
we're quite civilized in Shropshire.
What, I'm sorry?
Sorry, that was a dig at London. I said we're quite civilized in Shropshire.
Let the dogs run, right? Exactly.
Yes.
But these dog runs are just curious, because you bring all of these different kinds of dogs together along with all these different kinds of owners. And Randolph, being, you know, who he is going to make observations about what this means. So here it goes. He's at the dog run at this moment. And the dog run is right near the Natural History Museum. It's called the Bull Moose Dog Run, named after Teddy Roosevelt's political party. But anyway, the purpose for most canine outings in New York City is bodily necessity. You can tell a lot about a dog by the way he or she approaches a number one and a number two. There are, for example, the zigzag dumpers, for whom a number two is impossible, if not preceded by a pell-mell dash through the undergrowth with their owners either leashed in tow or shouting from a quarter mile away. Then there are the squat and drops. Squat and drops never stand on ceremony. They couldn't care less who was in the immediate vicinity. When they need to do their business, there is no stopping them. A New York dog run has all kinds. Plenty of zigzag dumpers and squat and drops, of course, but also the more demure foliage finders who refuse to be seen in process. The picky asphalt onlys, real city dogs who never go on grass or dirt. And their opposites, the earth onlys, who never go on the asphalt. It is tempting to be a breedist to assume a bulldog will be a squat and drop and a poodle a foliage finder, but this would be a mistake. I had known the best groomed poodles to act like shameless squat and drops, and more than one Alaskan husky has proven an easily embarrassed foliage finder. More yours truly, Speed. In fact, Randolph is indeed a foliage finder. and let's see, I'm just going to jump down. And then he makes observations on the owners. Owners, you see, fall into categories just as easily as their pets. There seem to be two major pet-owning characters, the apologizers and the apologists. The apologizers take the blame for everything their dog does or does not do. They do so vocally and with body language, usually sweeping gestures of surprise and shrinking postures of shame. The apologizer seems shocked that his or her dog would push through the legs of a crowd at the intersection or do a number two right in the middle of the street. The apologist is the exact opposite. He, it's usually he, seems to take pride when his 100-pound junkyard dog mounts someone's long-haired chihuahua or gobbles down a child's ice cream. The apologist animal is like a surrogate free spirit that keeps the owner safely removed from the bad behavior while permitting him to strut around the streets of Manhattan with caveman bravado. So that was Randolph's take on dog and human culture and how it blends. And a lot of the time, of course, Randolph is totally paralyzed. You know, I mean, he's powerless in the sense he's not some talking or walking, obviously, on two-legged dog. Like, he's not a cartoon dog. He's completely constrained by what a dog is. You know, he can't speak.
Yeah.
So he has to figure out ways of getting around that problem, particularly when there's a mystery to solve or some kind of urgency, like having to get out of the apartment, to go do his numbers or to get fed or something before Harry takes off.
I have to say, you know, I remember from reading the book, the passages that you've just read out, and what struck me was this is obviously written, you know, by someone who knows the realities of dog life, who has observed that, who has spent time at the dog park, you know, and has observed owners and dogs, and that does come across, that you are a dog person.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true. And Ruby, our angler, my dog, is a Labrador Retriever. She's from Australia. My wife's Australian.
Yeah.
And we flew her in from the outback. She had been living in a town of about 1,200 people. And arrives in New York with 8 million plus and sort of just adapted instantly. You know, she got off the plane and sort of just was right onto the streets. And she wasn't fazed at all. It was amazing.
Aww.
But with a dog in tow, you know, you learn a lot about, you see a whole other New York, because I mean a whole other New York. I mean, I've lived here a long time. I was born here in Manhattan and it's a totally different city with a dog.
Yes.
You see all the people who don't know how to handle dogs or probably shouldn't own dogs. And then the people who do, you know, who are great with dogs and it's a free for all. It really is.
Yes.
I mean, there are people over here who they're dog walkers, you know, and so you see 10, 12 dogs on a leash, on one single lead running together, and dog runners actually. Randolph runs a blog called adogabouttown.com, and he talks about some of the new phenomenon in New York, one of them, which is the dog running, where they try to exhaust the hyperactive dogs by, you know, having a triathlete run them through the park.
Oh, I like it.
You know, there's no end to stuff. I mean, I heard and then I bump into dog walkers, and one told me a story that happened some years ago about Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary, what was he, Secretary of State, who had a dog, and his dog, was being taken for a walk, and I was just, and another dog did a dump on her head or something. It's hilarious. I mean, you never know. It's a whole world that opens up with the dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally different, because you know all the dogs have to go walking, whether they're living in $10 million apartments or in a rent-controlled walk-up.
Oh,
they all have to get out there and they all mingle. So it's a very great democratic stew.
It is. I think the other thing that I always notice is, it doesn't matter who you talk to. If it's another dog person, you just do, the conversation flows because you have that big, you know, passion in common.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it definitely does. And then another thing that definitely happens, certainly happens over here, is you never know the owner's names. You only know the dog's names.
Yes.
So our street is suddenly, it's as if you've put on this special dog lens, and all you see are the dogs. And then the humans come next, and there's sort of shadowy figures, but the dogs you definitely know.
Yes, yeah.
You recognize the dogs.
Yes, and you go, oh, there's Bob's owner. Yes, I know, yeah.
Exactly. You know, and of course, there's no end of names, crazy names for dogs. And and all sorts of, I mean, it's terrific. And the dog runs are great. I mean, I tend to actually steer away from the dog runs now. We tend to go for the Central Park off the leash when we can, when the legal times, usually. Because, you know, it's great to see them run through the park and what have you. And the dog runs can really be a free-for-all, you know. I mean, you never know, so.
Yeah. So, were you a dog person before Ruby, or has Ruby
converted? Oh, always had dogs. But I had never had a dog in the city. And you know, one thing, too, is they say, well, you can't, you know, we live in a tiny apartment, and you can't, they say, oh, it's unfair to dogs, big dogs, to have them in an apartment. I don't think that's true at all. Because certainly Labradors really love being with their owners.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're particularly active dogs. I mean, Randolph is a pretty good example of, you know, as long as he's fed and, you know, has a place to lie down and relax, cozy corner, he's going to be pretty happy. And
yeah.
Get out once in a while. And, I mean,
you can't beat
right
it
now as I speak.
Oh, yeah. No, you can't beat a Labrador. I've got a black lab.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yes. You know? Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great. What's her name?
Or her Buddy. Name? His name, Buddy. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're really special dogs. I mean, I do like all dogs, but I think Labradors are really particularly special. But
yeah. They just have Buddy just has such an enthusiasm for life, and the tail's always waggy. It's like, hey, let's meet them, let's meet that dog, that person, everything. But as you say, by the same token, if it's sort of a day when you think, well, no, I have to work today, he's quite happy. As long as you're there, he'll curl up, good as gold.
Well, that's it, exactly. It's like, it's almost like turning on a switch with Ruby. I mean, if I was to say right now, which I won't, I'll just spell it out. You know, let's go O-U-T.
Yeah.
She'd immediately get up, and she would bow down, and then I'd get the leash, and then we'd go. You know, and she'd be ready for it.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing. You can learn so much from dogs. I think they're the model for how we probably should be behaving most of the time, you know? I mean,
yes.
With this idea of just a general enthusiasm, ready for things and as they come.
Yeah.
Terrific. Yeah. Now, the funny thing about it is that Randolph, in a way, is more like if you're familiar with the Odd Couple, I think his temperament is more like the, you know, Felix on the Odd Couple.
Yeah.
He's kind of a he's less. You know, he's almost less Labrador-like, although he can't help it. He's kind of in this Labrador body, which is pretty happy all the time, wagging his tail and what have you. So, the outside world, he appears that way.
Yeah. Now, I can't wait to see what he gets up to in Dog Among Diplomats. So, can we have a taster of that one now?
Yeah, well, that's a good idea.
Okay.
Let me grab it. This is a good prequel, because tomorrow I'm doing a reading down in the Village in New York, at Crime and Partners in Crime, which is a bookstore down there.
Yeah.
Well, one thing he gets up to is gives away too much to say that he almost gets cooked. The Dog Among Diplomats sees Randolph becoming a therapy dog for a anxious diplomat at the UN in New York, and so he's undercover. And unfortunately, he gets, you know, there's a big, pretty big, wide palate at the UN. They've got a great dining room, and they serve all sorts of things. And unfortunately, one of the chefs thinks that it would be great if they had dog. And so he gets sort of dog-napped up to one of the midnight kitchens at the UN. Nobody's around to save him. And he's too tired, because he's been at the vets to try to even escape.
Yeah.
And so all he's doing is waiting for his end. So I'm going to read, what set the scene here. A radio in the background played Sinatra. The signal went in and out, and the singer's legendary phrasing sounded strained as he worked his way through that tribute to the metastatic ego, My Way. I've always been most fond of his work in Guys and Dolls, and now Delirious wondered if Luck Be a Lady would be the backdrop to my demise, and whether I would be offered a cigarette, like the condemned in an old black-and-white movie about the French Foreign Legion. But of course, those who become poultry and pork loins are afforded no such option at their exit, so why should a Labrador? Was I a white meat? Would I taste like chicken or yak? The night, the city seemed so far away. The threat of one's own death destroys the romantic dream, and each nook and corner of civility, each small joy and peaceful habit, becomes a mockery buried beneath the sudden details of biological terror. The details of an extinction that suddenly seems so intimate and so inevitable. Milo had chosen the easy cook option. He returned with the largest roasting pan I have ever seen. Soon I was being garnished. Sinatra was off, and the radio had gone into a commercial for Tempur-Pedic brand mattresses. So there.
Oh.
So he's in trouble.
He is, isn't he? Gosh.
But he's still being philosophical about it.
Yes. Oh, bless him.
And he's noticing all the details. So.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, well, I hope he makes it to the end of the book, though.
Well, he has to.
Well, this is it.
Or maybe I can ghostwrite it for him if he doesn't. I won't give anything more away. I think he
no.
does. I wrote it last year, so I don't know what happened.
No, you can't remember. Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Okay, if people, you've mentioned the blog. So again, this is written by Randolph, isn't it?
Yeah, this is Randolph's, near daily attempt to kind of get more observations out there.
Yeah.
And most of the time he just comments on, events, both dog and man, world events, and strange stories like the snake in Australia who ate a chihuahua and other things like that, and skateboarding dogs and things. And, sometimes he just panders directly to the lower natures of the dog breeding public.
Okay. Well, we'll pop a link onto that. But can you tell us the address?
Oh, what's that?
The
website. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's www.adogabouttown.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay, smashing. And as I say, we'll put
it on. Randolph, remember, he has to type it all out with his snout. So, and in fact, in Dog Among Diplomats, he discovers the internet, which is an important thing. Opens a whole other window onto life for him.
Yeah. It's brilliant. Because I think the thing is, when you live with a dog, you do start to sort of look at them and think, I wonder what you think of that and how you react inside to that. And it's kind of a continuation of that, to actually write, with this voice, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, someone said something in a kind of more serious vein. I mean, Randolph is oftentimes plays off of the fact that he's a captive, because he is. He's dependent on the mercies of his owner and humankind in general. But he makes fun of it a lot, and he has a certain freedom in his mind to kind of travel around in a way.
Yeah.
And look at the whole spectacle and kind of make fun of it. But someone said one reader who said to me, it was something that really stuck in my mind, which was we have I forget how he phrased it, but something like, we sort of have an obligation to stick up for the silent, to the people to the entities or beings, creatures who can't speak for themselves. He was talking about it because he's constantly seeing these dogs being left outside stores and what have you, just sort of tied up in New York, and dogs do get taken, things like that. But I think it's true. I mean, Randolph, in a way, is aware of that. It made me aware of that. You do wonder what your dog's thinking. You also realize that they can't communicate that very well, with the exception of some kind of pretty basic maneuver.
Yes.
But
yeah.
You see it. I think you see it all in their eyes. I mean, I think there's a lot there.
Oh yes. Yeah. And my Labrador will stand where the food is on the shelf, and he'll flick his eyes at it. And he definitely, and I'll say to my husband, come and look, he's doing it. And as soon as Anthony looks, Buddy will stop doing it then. And it's almost like, he'll only do it for me. And that's his mode. He flicks his eyes. He's like, looks at you, looks at what he wants, looks at you, looks at what he wants. And that's his method.
Yeah, it's funny you said that about the eyes. I just started noticing that in Ruby. She definitely does that. And I never really... The only thing is that I don't think that they have complete control over where they're going to be pointing their head all the time.
Yes.
Maybe they get too excited. One funny thing was that the eyes, though, tell us a lot, I think. She does. She'll look at things, or she'll look... And recently she's been coming really... I can tell that she expresses a lot of exasperation in her eyes with me, because I have, you know, things going on in the morning. I got to take her out, but if I have to, you know, she'll give me a stern look if I'm not on the ball. But she never barks. She never barks.
Doesn't she?
No, very rarely. It has to be something pretty important. She has this kind of Crocodile Dundee quality to her, you know, where she can't get too ruffled.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love that about, you know, a lot of the Australians that you meet. They're so laid back, and that's just so brilliant.
It is, and trust me, it's been transferred to the Labrador in my living room. It's really extraordinary. She, you know, you'll have these yapping poodles and little dachshunds and pit bulls, and she just doesn't get worried at all.
Yeah,
she never does. Yeah. I mean, she gets appropriately worried if she has to.
Right? Yes, yeah.
But she doesn't. You know, she's not going to just pull the alarm every 5 seconds. So
yeah.
But Labradors are special, and she's
definitely
something.
Definitely. But, now, can you assure us? Do you have the idea for the third book in the Baldwin series?
Oh, the third book.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. Tentatively titled "A Dog at Sea."
Oh wow!
And yes, and Randolph will most likely be heading off onto a dog training singles cruise.
Ooh.
With a cast of characters. It'll be something of a, you know, there'll be a strong mystery inside of it, actually, this time.
Yeah.
But also the long mystery, because the mystery with Imogen doesn't get solved right away.
Right.
Now, Imogen's the main character, you know, from the lady love that follows kind of both Randolph and Randolph's owner and Harry, who's Harry's owner as well. I mean, Randolph's owner as well. They're looking for her. So that'll continue on the Dog at Sea. But yeah, there's definitely, it's going to be pretty comedic on board ship, because there'll be all sorts of types trying to get special training for their dogs, along the, you know how there's like, there's the dog whisperer. So this ship will have like a dog mutterer. So we'll use Tourette's like commands to ensure communication with the dogs. Desperate attempt to understand those eyelashes.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, I'm glad Randolph's future is assured then, you know.
Yes, got the ideas. We're working on it right now, so we'll make an announcement, but he should keep going for the near future.
I'm so glad that Randolph will be around for a good while yet, and I can't wait to read A Dog Among Diplomats. We have two copies of J.F. Englert's first novel, A Dog About Town, that you could win one of. All you have to do is email us with the name of the canine narrator of the novel, and at the end of June, we'll pick two entries at random and mail the book out to you. Good luck! In the meantime, you can access that clever canine character's blog via the link on the Dogcast Radio site. You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Hello and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Nick.
And I'm Kate. A dog in Iowa has taken on the role as a foster mother to a litter of kittens. The dog in question is Lily, a lab cross taken in by the Humane Society shortly before she gave birth to six puppies. Luckily, the puppies were all found good homes, which left Lily with an empty nest, until the orphan kittens arrived. Staff tried them in with Lily and were delighted when she started taking good care of them.
It has been noted before that dogs seem to be able to recognise the young of another species and be aware that they're vulnerable and even in need of care. Sometimes this ability brings about strange liaisons. For example, Magnum, the Doberman Pinscher in Florida, has developed a bond with three orphaned creatures, this time ducklings. The tiny ducks turned up at Magnum's home, and his owners were surprised but pleased when he started looking after them. Now the odd foursome sit together and even groom one another.
Is this a case of a dog who's gone quackers? Clearly these dogs have committed themselves to parenthood. But in the UK there is a scheme on offer where you can enjoy a dog without the commitment. Yes, Flex Pets has made it to Britain, and it's causing a stir. Gucci, an 18-month-old Pomeranian, can be rented once a week at a cost of £279, approximately $540, per month. A comparable service is an offer in America for the equivalent of only £144, approximately $270, a month.
But it's not the cost that is causing problems. Animal charities, the RSPCA, and Dogs Trust are eager to speak to organisers as they have concerns about the welfare of any dogs involved. The charities question whether the arrangement meets the dog's need for security and routine, and who the service actually benefits. Local authorities also have legal issues to resolve. As the charities point out, people wishing to interact with dogs without the long-term commitment could volunteer at their local shelter, or even foster dogs who are waiting for their forever home, all for free.
Of course, if you do choose to have a dog in your life permanently, the costs can mount up, although not equally for every breed. A survey carried out by pet insurers Esure discovered that Chihuahua owners spend the most on their pets, with some spending as much as £90,000, approximately $175,000, during their pet's lifetime. Clearly, tiny dogs don't mean tiny bills. Chihuahua owners are also most likely to buy their pets tasty treats, such as fresh meat, vegetables and gravy, as well as decking them out in stunning bling. The average cost of other breeds over the course of a doggy lifetime was £31,000, approximately $60,000, with greyhounds being the second most expensive at around £82,000, approximately $160,000, and mastiffs in third place costing around £81,000, approximately $156,000. The most expensive costs for all breeds were veterinary bills, food, and boarding kennel fees.
In truth, though, you can't put a price on the companionship of a dog, especially if that dog is a therapy dog. When Kim Foreman, a Vietnam veteran living in Australia, came out of a coma, his recovery was greatly aided by the presence of his golden Labrador puppy, Bella. Kim's wife was advised by doctors to buy Bella as a replacement after Kim's dog of 18 years died. The plan worked, and Bella was helping Kim struggle back to health, until thieves stole her. Kim was heartbroken, and despite advertising and appealing for the pup's return, nothing more was heard of her. Now, thanks to Bella's generous breeder, Kim has a new pup to keep him company, Bella's brother, Bruce. Let's hope Bruce gets to be with Kim for a good long time, and that Kim's recovery continues.
And finally, in America, a dog is busy with a recovery of her own, after having the first dog corneal implant in the US. The surgery restored sight to a 7-year-old mountain cur called Dixie. Poor Dixie had been going slowly blind, and it had impacted on her health and her confidence. Now, after a delicate 2-step procedure, which involved removing the old damaged cornea and replacing it with a plastic one, Dixie can see again. Although artificial corneas have been given to many humans, this is a fairly new development for dogs. But the team that worked on Dixie say it is marvellous to see the improvement in her sight and her quality of life. And her owner is delighted that she can see too.
And that's all from us on the Dogcast Radio News Desk. Goodbye.
I guess you don't really own a dog. You rent them. And you have to be thankful that you had a long lease. Joe Garagiola. We were contacted by a listener who had heard Paula Terrify in episode 61 of Dogcast Radio arguing against breed-specific legislation. Bob Cardone has had experiences that led him to think differently, and in the interest of balance, here's what he had to say.
I am in kind of an unusual situation where I actually physically live right next to a dog park. And I'm there probably 2-3 times a day.
Yeah.
And this has been for about a year and a half. Plus, there's another park about 2 miles from my house, and I frequently go to that park, too. And this is in Atlanta, Georgia, and Atlanta's a rather large city. It's a population of about 5 million, 4.5 million people now. And there are a lot of inner city neighborhoods, and the dog of choice For a lot of the people that live in these neighborhoods, especially the younger kids, teenagers, is the pit bull.
Mm.
And I think one of the reasons that the that this dog is attracting these teenage owners is that it has kind of a reputation for being a tough dog, and a lot of these kids are mostly boys, teenage boys. They feel like this gives them some stature in the community, having a dog that's kind of macho.
Yeah, yeah. So they don't—they're not going to socialize the dog and sort of encourage it to be anything other than tough, are they?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's almost—I could, you know, say that maybe they train the dog to fight, and I'm sure that that situation exists here in Atlanta. You probably heard about the famous football player Michael Vick that played in a team here, and when he got thrown in jail for dog fighting, there were a lot of the local people here in the inner city that were defending him and acting like, you know, this is no big deal, this is done every day. Exactly. So there is a lot of that here, but I think that a lot of these dogs are just bought by people that really aren't into dogs. That some of the owners that buy them, it's like a new kind of trinket or a new kind of, you know, groovy kind of thing.
Yes.
And because a lot of these, some of these kids are gang members, this again, the tough dog type of posture or reputation that this dog has attracts this type of owner that buys the dog.
Yeah.
So now 6 months later, and a lot of these dogs are sold out of cardboard boxes and shopping centers and ads and newspapers, classified ads, for not a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because people get the dog, they don't neuter and spay the dogs, and then they wind up with a litter of puppies, and they don't know what to do with them, so they just, you know, throw an ad in the newspaper and try to give them to whoever will walk in the door with $100 or $150 in cash.
Yeah.
And now the dog is transferred to somebody that has no idea of what they're getting into.
Yes.
And then, you know, 4 or 5 months later, you wind up with a dog that's not socialized, has very little training. I see them approaching me all the time in the dog park, and they're usually pulling like mad on the leash and growling at people, and the owner has no control over them. And if the owner tries to bring the dog into the dog park, all the other people that are in the park at the time, they all run for the exit gate, and because they don't know how this dog is going to react with other dogs, and realizing that the owner probably has little to no control over the dog.
Yeah, yeah. I think it strikes me that, you know, what Paula was saying was, it's not a breed problem, you know, it's not a dog problem, it's an owner problem. And it sounds to me as if you're saying the same thing, you know, it's the owners are doing the wrong thing with the dogs. So
the place where Paul and I differ on this, and I hear this all the time from pit bull owners, the first thing they come out with is, well, the dog isn't bred to attack people. It's only bred to attack other dogs, at least going back when the dogs were into dog fighting.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is when your 10 or 11-year-old boy or, you know, son or daughter is out walking your little, you know, black lab or something, and one of these pit bulls comes loose and runs up to attack your son's dog, the odds are that your son is going to try to defend his dog, and now you've got this pit bull, which is a potentially lethal animal, attacking the dog owner.
Yes, yeah.
It could be a kid. There's been numerous reports of this right in my metropolitan area in the last year or two. In fact, I was in an emergency vet hospital about 10 months ago, and a gentleman and his wife came in with a dog. The dog's leg, the dog was about an 11 or 12-pound dog. The dog's rear leg was almost severed off completely by the neighbor's pit bull.
Mm.
And the dog's the fellow's daughter tried to intervene, and she got nicked up, and they had to take her to the hospital. Luckily, she didn't get hurt badly.
Yeah.
But his dog was just in really bad shape. And, I mean, this guy was so angry. he wanted to go home and get a revolver and go over and shoot this pit bull.
Yeah.
That's how mad. And I talked him out of it because I said, you know, you're just going to wind up in jail.
Yes, yeah.
And the best thing is to call animal control and the police department and put in a report and let them deal with it.
Yes, yeah.
But I also knew another person that physically had to pick up and move. Somebody moved next to them, the house right next to them. They had two pit bulls running around in the yard. Periodically, they would jump the fence, and he was afraid to let his kids and his dog out of the house without him around because he was afraid, because these dogs were, like, really dog aggressive.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the combination of those things. I mean, if I'm making myself clear on
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
it's a combination of attracting an owner that doesn't seem to be really... To me, somebody that buys a dog like a pit bull or a German shepherd, that owner has to be dedicated to making sure that dog is trained well and socialized.
Yes, yeah.
And if you're not going to be that way, that's not the dog for you. Maybe you should get a Yorkie or I don't know whether they're, you know, that much easier to train, but at least you don't have to worry about them ripping your arm off, you know.
Yeah. I think we ought to say every dog needs socialization. I think you've hit the nail on the head. If a Yorkie turns, it doesn't do as much damage. And so they get away with, you know, if anything happens, it doesn't inflict the damage, does it? All dogs need socialization, you know, and training and sort of putting in their place. But we're talking about big, powerful dogs that will do some damage if they turn.
And they're very tenacious dogs. I mean, there's been several reports right here in Atlanta where the police have been called and they have shot the dog. And the first, and sometimes the second shot didn't even stop the dog from attacking.
Mm.
Once the dog got into that attack mode. And, you know, and people have had the same thing, and they wind up being mauled and disfigured, and sometimes it's even a fatal situation.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, this whole thing started with your the guest that was discussing this, talking about breed-specific legislation
That's
and how
it,
long
yes.
it is and stuff. And I understand her point. But what I'm trying to show is that there's another side to this story, and it's that people don't want to be like that friend of mine that had to actually sell his house and move because the neighbor moved in next door with a couple of dangerous animals and there wasn't anything he could do about it.
Yeah.
So what they figure is their only move is just to go up to the city fathers or the local mayor and try to get some kind of legislation that would eliminate this danger from their neighborhood. And this is how this BSL starts.
Yeah. So, and obviously you're saying you're in favor of breed specific.
Well, I have no solution. I don't know whether that's good or not, but there is no solution. What I hear, the common thing is people say, well, it's the owner's fault, as you were saying before. It's not the dog. So blame the owner if something happens. Well, you know, that's fine. But how do you explain to an 11-year-old girl that has her face disfigured for the rest of her life that it's really not the dog's fault and it's the owner's fault
and
this breed shouldn't be banned?
Yeah.
Then it's a reactionary thing. You know, it's like, okay, my daughter got bitten or my son got bitten or my wife got bitten or whatever, and now we'll sue the owner. Well, that doesn't stop the initial attack from happening.
No. I mean, it is a very complicated problem, isn't it?
Exactly. And as I said, I have no solution. I'm not calling up saying, because that's another slippery slope. You can go down, you start banning this breed, and the next thing you know, somebody says, well, I think you should add Rottweilers to that, and then German Shepherds, and right on down the line, and my son got bit by a Chihuahua, so let's ban them too. So that could go on endlessly. But there are a very high number of incidents of pit bull attacks, at least around where I live, and I think that's why people are gravitating towards wanting a BSL in some places. And in some places, they've had them for quite a while, I guess.
Yes.
Miami, I think somewhere out in Colorado,
yeah.
Denver maybe.
Yeah. I guess in the States as well, maybe it's complicated with, you know, the different states have different laws, don't they? Because I was reading about, now this person might have been in Canada, but she was saying she won't drive through a certain, you know, area, because with her dog in the back, it resembles a pit bull, and it can just be taken away from her. You know, in the UK, we don't have that problem, because the law just extends to the edge of the island kind of thing. I mean, there's slight variations, having said that, because we have the different assemblies. But in the main, you can go where you like, and the law of the land is the law of the land. It's slightly different in America, isn't it?
Yeah, and there are some, you know, it's depending on the way the statute is written, that there are some statutes that say, for instance, a pit bull or a pit bull mix.
Yes, yeah.
So, you know, some people will say, oh, that dog's got four legs and ears. That might be a pit bull mix.
Yes.
So, you know,
So
that's another slippery slope that you go on. But, you know, and I work as a volunteer for a shelter here, and there's another problem that a lot of these dogs, when they're not trained and not socialized, they get into the shelter. And the shelters are afraid of the liability of adopting the dog out to somebody, so they pretty much euthanize them.
Yeah.
I work for a no-kill shelter, so that doesn't happen. But we've had pit bulls for a couple of years in there that just will never get adopted out from living. Just, they were in bad shape when they came in, and then after a few months in a shelter, they're really not in a position to be socialized because they're, you know, confined in a cage pretty much all day or in a small outside area.
Yeah.
It's a very high rate of these dogs being euthanized once they're turned in by the owners because the owner can't control the dog anymore.
Yeah. Bob, you're obviously a dog lover. Are you a dog owner yourself?
Yeah, I adopted. I haven't had a dog for years because I traveled. I worked for a Belgian company for years and traveled all over the U.S. So I had a cat. But I retired 2 years ago, and I adopted a dog from the Snow Kill shelter. She'd been in there for 10 months.
Gosh.
When I adopted her, and she's just my best friend now.
Yes.
In fact, I rate her over most of the people that I know. You know. And so I know what it's like to have a dog that you really love, and the, you know.
Yeah.
And have a dog that's well trained and stuff like that. And I feel sorry for dogs that aren't trained and see people yanking the dog around instead of trying to control the dog properly and train the dog. It's just sad, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Bob, I think this one will rumble on, and everybody's got a different opinion on it. But thanks for getting in touch.
Okay, and enjoy your show. I listen to it all the time on my iPod.
Cheers.
It is a difficult issue that provokes very strong feeling. And if you'd like to let us know what you think about breed-specific legislation, you can leave a message on the phone lines that you'll hear at the end of the show. We have a UK number and a US one. Or, of course, you can email us. I have a dog, and sometimes I'll be the littlest kid with my dog and marvel at his ears and his nose and how he looks at me. If he died, I'd bawl like a baby. Aaron Eckhart. Now we have a short story written and read by Winfried Peppink, author of The Diplomatic Dog of Barbados. In this story, Dee Dee is living in Bahrain.
The ship of the desert. The diplomatic dog swaggered up the gates of the compound as though he was a regimental sergeant major about to address a group of pimply-faced new recruits. And then he stopped suddenly and stared. There, at the gates, was something he had never seen before. And the strange creature was surrounded by a host of similar cohorts which had spilled across the road that ran from his compound and away into the desert reaches. His hesitation was but momentary before he proceeded further, but his pace slowed as he manoeuvred to take a closer look. He hunched his shoulders ever so slightly so that his confident stride of a moment ago took on more of a slope, and his ears, which usually moulded sleekly to the shape of his head when he was at pace, were now out wide, like an aircraft landing. There was caution with his every move, his eyes never leaving the creature, fully focused and alert, his head slightly tilted, as though trying to gauge a perspective, his nose twitching constantly, at the unfamiliar smell. The hackles on his neck were like speed brakes on an aeroplane, seemingly pushing him lower to the ground, while the sinews and ligaments in his powerful legs were taut, ready to propel him forward or into flight. And still he came forward, although now ever so slowly. The creature stood his ground and stared back through fierce black and angry eyes, the white surrounding them the colour of plum yogurt. He blinked through long eyelashes, then stared again like a death ray at the approaching dog. It slowly lowered its monstrous head and flared its gums to show two yellowed buck teeth and a lolling dark tongue. And then it hissed like a kettle, warning of impending tea time, low at first and almost a whistle to a full head of steam. And then, without warning, it spat a fat globule of phlegm in the direction of the dog, like a warning shot. It fell short, and the dog did not flinch, but at least the camel saw that the dog had now stopped coming forward and was crouched low, just observing, his stomach moving in and out to show that he was breathing rapidly. Hissing even more loudly, the camel lifted his head, like a wave rising before it breaks, looked down on the dog, and then again lowered it, like a coma approaching the beach. At the same time, it took a step towards the dog and had the satisfaction of seeing him move slightly backwards. There were young camels to protect, and he would do so now. The camel had seen packs of dogs nipping at the young one's heels and barking loudly, so that the frenzied little ones broke and ran in all directions. Then he had run towards them, scattering the dogs and kicking out with his large hooves whenever he could. But being lean and wiry, as dead mongrel dogs invariably are, they had easily avoided him. They had retreated and had kept their distance, but barked their obscenities from afar. The camel would keep this mongrel now before him, at bay too. A shout from a turbaned cameleer broke the tension. With one hand he struck the camel on its long, broad neck, and while whirling a short swatting stick in the air, he pushed the camel towards the roadway with his other hand. The camel turned reluctantly, like a prize fighter who is pushed to his corner by the referee, hissed once more, and padded slowly back to the road, its double-jointed footfall making it look as though it stumbled slightly, till its ligaments stretched taut, the legs straightened at the ankle, and it padded slowly away. Through the bars of the gate, the camel looked to the diplomatic dog as though it was somehow imprisoned, but soon all he saw was a swinging tail with a furry knot at the end, a bit like a lion, and then that too was gone. Outside the gates, the cameleer cuffed the camel on his broad rump, and for a few seconds it broke into a swaying shuffle, its pads falling almost noiselessly on the surface of the road. The camel swiveled its neck and looked back, whether at the cameleer or for a sign of the dog, it was hard to tell, but then it straightened again and held its head up high and threaded its way through the young camels, like a cruiser going through a convoy of ships. A moment later, the ship of the desert was again at the head of the convoy, its head held high, and its sharp eyes looking for any sign of danger. "Follow me, little ones, and I will protect you," he seemed to say. The diplomatic dog, Didi for short, walked slowly to the gate and through his narrowed eyes looked in the direction of the camel pack and watched them shuffling down the road. A cameleer moved along behind them, rapping laggards with a stick and always making sure that he was nowhere near an aimlessly aimed occasional kick. Bitter experience had taught him that it was not only mules that kicked if you got too close to their hindquarters. Indeed, in his native Afghanistan, there was a saying that fermented camel's milk had the kick of a camel. But as a good Muslim, he had never imbibed, although he did have a fondness for laban, as the Arabs called fresh camel milk. Didi now looked across the road and saw it was spattered with camel dung, big, straw-green pats which had hit the ground like bombs, scattering their mess everywhere. And they had relieved themselves too. What uncouth creatures, he thought. At least he peed tangentially, and always on a pole, tree, or bush. Very carefully, like someone picking his way along a pathway between crocodile ponds, he found his way across the road to the more familiar dirt on the other side, sniffing occasionally, but wrinkling his nose. Who are those guys? He thought. Each morning, Miss Wendy and Dee Dee set out from the compound where they lived and trekked off for their walk, picking their way through the limestone rocks. They passed three ancient burial mounds from the time of the Dilmun civilization, well over 2,000 years ago. Big, circular, 10-meter-high tors of soil which had been partly uncovered by archaeologists to reveal various burial chambers built into the limestone. In the old days, the burial chambers were covered with soil so that they looked like small pimples, the shape of a volcano. Much of Bahrain, prior to its development as a modern, vibrant state, was once a vast burial ground with similar but smaller tombs for ordinary citizens. There were many archaeologists who thought that Bahrain was in fact the Garden of Eden, as described in the Bible. Sometimes Dee Dee would climb to the top of the large mounds and look in at the chambers, and then stand looking into the shimmering distance as though he was trying to locate distant Barbados. Then he would run down the slope, flat out, like those people in England who chase a cheese wheel down a steep hill. It was Dee Dee at his sleekest, ears and tail streamlined to offer no resistance to the wind, legs going like the clappers, mouth slightly open to suck in the air. As the momentum lessened and his run slowed, he would turn in a wide arc and lope back to Miss Wendy with a lopsided grin, his eyes shining with glee, as if to say, "Boy, I bombed that slope, just like Alberto Tomba in the Olympic downhill." At this hour of the morning, however, there was no time for silliness, and Diddy merely trotted past the mounds, the early morning sun already a grasping red ball, its rays like hot breath saying, "Boy, have I got a scorcher planned for you today." As most days in July reach close to 50 degrees centigrade, this was the only time of day to walk, and the rest of Didi's days was spent on a sheepskin rug in the air-conditioned house until the sizzling sun sank into the waters of the Gulf. In between, there was only time for a quick foray outside for a pee, and then a hurried return indoors. Now, however, Dee Dee trotted easily ahead of Miss Wendy in a sort of ambling shuffle, a bit like that Australian marathoner who used to train in gumboots. Dee Dee looked as though he could go at that pace all day. His russet, short-haired coat was almost golden in the sun, and his pink tongue protruded almost elegantly between the canyon entrance of his prominent front teeth. Occasionally, he gave a long, lingering lick to keep his top jaw moist, but for the most part, he just panted evenly. He simply loved his walks, and early in the morning, he would stand beside Miss Wendy's bed and make mewing noises till she woke. Then, when she yawned and said, "Okay, Diddy, walkies," he pranced like a Lipizzaner horse at the Spanish riding school in Vienna, his head pulled back and twisting, his front paws moving like a trotter, until she put on her walking shoes and attached his lead. Then he was off, pulling hard at the lead, straining for a smell of cats. Once across the road, the lead came off, and he sprinted to the nearby, and usually overflowing, rubbish bin and searched for morsels, despite Miss Wendy's admonition. It did not matter that each night he dined on lamb shanks, chicken breasts, or fish fillets. Clearly you could take the dog out of the junkyard, but never the junkyard out of the dog. They wandered on through the dusty landscape, past villas being constructed in the ever more prosperous Bahrain, and across a black bitumen road, and then into a palm grove that looked like it had existed in biblical times. The palm trees, though somewhat squat, were big and fat, with fronds that sprouted at the top and cascaded down the trunk, like beer foaming out of a bottle. They were closely planted so that they gave an abundance of shade and gave the impression of a green columned temple. Nearby, where the fronds protruded, big bunches of yellow dates hung heavily from a straining branch. In some places, the dates had already been harvested and lay on a coarse cloth covering the ground, all yellow, red, and black, ready for eating before the evening prayers. The morning call to prayer had been much earlier and had come in the half-light before the sun had risen. Then the sound from the loudspeakers had rolled across the land like a mystical chant, alluring and ancient. Now all was in stillness, awaiting the heat of the day. Bees buzzed around the dates as though on a last errand before they too sought sanctuary. In between the plots of green okra and white cauliflower, an ancient irrigation system of small canals flowed from between the trees. Everywhere the soil grasped for sustenance before the sun baked the land yet again. Under the trees were narrow little earthen paths along which the workers walked to change the flow of water or to harvest the dates. It was cool and restful, almost enchanting, and Didi loved the smorgasbord of aromas as he dashed from place to place, sniffing here, cocking a leg there. He wanted every other dog to know that this was his place, and from time to time he drank lustily from the tiny canals to replenish his marking fluid, forestalling, if he could, through his display of exuberance, the time when Miss Wendy would say, "Home time, Didi." Miss Wendy looked up at the sky, shading her face against the sun, and said softly, "Didi, home time." For a moment he pretended not to listen and nosed around in a green bush, sniffing for signs of another visitor. Then, hearing her repeat the call, but with greater insistence, he looked up and gave her his, "Who, me?" look. "Yes, you," she said, smiling, as if by telepathy she had read his thoughts. "Come on, it's time for your bone." Now Didi had a well-developed vocabulary, and bone was one of those words that he readily understood. Bone and dinner were right at the top of his food chain of knowledge, and come to think of it, his morning snack did have its appeal. He therefore trotted up to Miss Wendy, and together they turned for home. The farm workers were already out toiling in the fields, working with hoes to till the soil, or climbing up rickety ladders to cut down more dates. As Miss Wendy passed them and gave a friendly wave and a salaam alaikum greeting, they waved cautiously in response, never taking their eyes off the dog, like Red Indians watching a cavalry column pass. Many had a rabid fear of dogs, and whenever they saw one, they stood stock still or picked up a stone. But Didi, probably sensitive to their plight, did not give them a glance and merely trotted on, mouth now slightly agape as he felt the sapping heat. Miss Wendy had made a timely call, he thought, and as he crossed the hot road surface and felt the heat radiating into his pads, he started to think already of his cool bowl of water in the air-conditioned house and the chilled bone. They were a few hundred metres from the road, maybe a quarter of a mile from home, when Didi started to lag and his trot fell away to a plod. Miss Wendy too was feeling the heat, and a little rivulet of perspiration ran down one side of her face while her polo shirt clung to her back. She turned around to look for Didi, and that is when it happened. With a cry of pain, her foot stumbled on a limestone rock, her ankle rolled, and with a thud she fell to the ground, raising a little cloud of dust. Her ankle throbbed and the pain was excruciating. For a moment she cared not a skerrick about her appearance, something no one in Bahrain would ever have thought possible, for her face, hair and clothes were caked in dust. Gingerly she sat up and felt the ankle, but it was hugely painful and she moaned. By this time, Didi, who had seen her fall, quickened his pace to come by her side, thinking that this was some sort of unusual game. "Oh, Didi," she said, with a little tremulous sound in her voice. I think I may have broken my ankle. Like a reassuring doctor, Didi wanted to comfort her, and he licked her hand, but right away he knew something was wrong. Miss Wendy knew she had to get up, because even though she was not too far from the road, she would simply not be seen lying here prone. Moreover, in the baking sun, she could well die if she went undiscovered. With great effort, she put her hand in the middle of Didi's back, near his shoulders, and pushed down to elevate herself onto her good leg. Although the measure was unusual, Didi merely braced himself to take the weight, and then stood there while she put the weight on the injured leg and gasped in pain. The ankle was hugely swollen where it met the leather of her walking shoe, but at least she felt it was not broken. Didi stood patiently, waiting for instructions. Miss Wendy inched forward, but immediately realized it would take her hours to get home, and she turned towards the road and started waving. But the cars sped by, oblivious to her plight. Now, shedding a tear, she hobbled to a nearby large stone and sat down heavily, cursing her foolishness for not carrying her mobile phone. If only she'd had the phone, she could have called for help. Now she was in a predicament. And then a curious thing happened. Didi started to wail like a banshee. When that did no good, he howled like a wolf. On the road, the cars zoomed by. People cocooned in their air-conditioned comfort, oblivious to Miss Wendy's plight. But someone did hear Didi's yelping, and curiosity about the mournful sound made the man tug at the camel's reins and head the beast in the direction of the noise. Then, from his high vantage point up on the camel's rump, he saw in the distance a brown dog howling into the sky, and beside him there was a person sitting on a rock. He struck the camel once with his stick, and it galumphed into a more rapid stride. Miss Wendy saw the camel and for a moment thought it was a mirage. Didi looked down and saw the loping creature heading straight towards them. Oh no, he thought. In a cloud of dust, the camel hove to, and although Didi was frightened, he remembered the time in Barbados when Miss Wendy had protected him from the horse and its rider. Now Miss Wendy was in pain, and it was his turn to be brave. The camel made a loud braying sound when the rider brought it to a halt, and from on high the cameleer heard Miss Wendy's tale of woe. Then he yelled at the camel and hit it with a stick before it brayed loudly once more and dropped down onto its front knees and then down onto its back knees so that eventually it rested on its belly and on its huge knee pads. Didi was astonished, for he had never seen anything like that before, and especially at such close quarters. With a deft movement, the man swung his leg over the camel's hump and jumped lightly to the ground. He was a man somewhat slight of stature, in white robes, with a rolled white cloth covering his head like a turban, and the cloth rolled down over his face, so that the only area around his eyes showed. That area was leathery and wrinkled, but his eyes were friendly and his manner warm. To Miss Wendy, he looked almost like an angel. "I'm a devout Muslim, madam," he said, "so I will not touch you to help you, you understand. But if you get yourself up to my camel, I will take you where you need to go." Now, Miss Wendy had once ridden a camel in Pakistan, but that was a long time ago, and then she had two perfectly sound ankles. Nevertheless, she managed to get to the back of the camel, and with great effort, while balancing on her good leg, she was able to throw the sore leg over its back. Then, clawing at the camel's hump with both her hands, and amid much shouting and wincing, she managed to seat herself astride the beast. With a shouted command of something like "Wooshta," the camel's rear end rose high in the sky, and Miss Wendy pushed at the hump to stop herself from pitching forward, and was somewhat relieved when the front end, still spitting and braying, came up too. Didi gave a look of concern as he saw Miss Wendy up high, holding onto the camel's hump to stop herself from falling off, and then, with an ungainly gait, the group headed for the compound. In the blistering sun, they looked distinctly biblical, the cameleer leading the grunting camel, Miss Wendy clinging on, and Didi bringing up the rear like a drover's dog. At the compound, there were many hands to help Miss Wendy off the camel, and Didi hovered nearby, making sure that everything was fine. Through her pain, Miss Wendy thanked the camel tear for rescuing her. He refused any money, saying it was Allah's will, and merely mounted the prone beast, shouted another command till it rose, and then spurred it away from the gates. Didi still harboured some fears of the camel, but they were overcome by his anxiety for Miss Wendy's welfare. A phone was found, a call to her husband ensued, and before long she was at the American Mission Hospital. The ankle was badly sprained, but it was not broken, and with it heavily strapped, Miss Wendy returned home on crutches. Didi was waiting anxiously at the door when she came into the villa, and she leaned down and patted his head. "You saved me, Didi," she said, in a voice filled with emotion and admiration, and then she hugged his neck. Didi knew that she was pleased, and he curled his lip to give her his special dog smile, which others sometimes interpreted as a readiness to attack. That night he dined on steak, New Zealand fillet steak. A week later, Miss Wendy was able to resume her walking routine, and Didi was very pleased. By coincidence, they saw the camels again that day, and while Didi still preferred to see them at a distance, he was no longer scared. He was very pleased, however, that just before they set out, Miss Wendy had put her mobile phone in her pocket.
Very sadly, in the last few days, I had an email from Winfred and his wife Wendy with the news that Didi had passed away. They are understandably heartbroken, and though they have wonderful memories and reminders of Didi, they miss him dreadfully. I hope their remaining dog, Lucy, brings them comfort as they recover from their loss. Thank you to Winfred for the story and taking the time to read it. And if you'd like to listen to a review of his book, telling of Didi's rags-to-riches story, check out episode 61 of Dogcast Radio. I think God will have prepared everything for our perfect happiness. If it takes my dog being there in heaven, I believe he'll be there. Reverend Billy Graham. I mentioned in the Dogcast Radio blog that Buddy and I have been participating in the bronze level of the Kennel Club Good Citizen Scheme. I'm very pleased to tell you that we've now passed the test. Before I looked into the scheme, I thought it would all be difficult tasks beyond us, but it's actually based firmly in the kind of behaviours that you teach your dog as a matter of course, like come back when called and don't pull me over when we walk. You also have to show that you can groom and examine your dog and answer a few simple questions. It reminds owners of a few of their responsibilities, like scooping the poop and meeting the basic needs of a dog. We have met a variety of lovely dogs and people at the class, from very young puppies to newly acquired rescue dogs to older dogs looking for an activity. And it's been great to rediscover the fun that training can be. One huge benefit is that although before the classes I would have said that Buddy walked well on a lead, I realise now that I was putting up with a lot of unnecessary pulling, which a surprisingly little amount of training has eliminated. His brain has switched into working mode, and when I give an instruction, he listens now. Well, most times anyway. There's a similar scheme run by the US Kennel Club, and wherever you live, it's worth checking if there's a class near you. It's definitely something Buddy and I will be persevering with, so stay tuned for news of our progress with the Silver Award. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
Why did the dog cross the road? Because it was the chicken's day off.